I added one more podcast to the giant podcast bin. Now you have plucked that podcast out and started listening.
I took my microphone and found some human folk. Then I recorded all the noises while we spoke.
My name is Adam Buxton, I'm a man.
I want you to enjoy this, that's the plan.
Hey, how you doing, podcats? Adam Buxton here. Ah, now what is that? It's like a light aircraft up there. Well, it isn't like a light aircraft. It is exactly a light aircraft. I couldn't tell you what kind, though. It looks like a child's toy. I personally wouldn't like to fly in it. It's a nice day, though, for a bit of flying, if that's an option. It's absolutely beautiful out here. On my walk with Rosie the dog. If you're a new listener to the podcast, welcome. I'm your anxious host. Rosie is my dog. She's a Whippet Poodle Cross. She's up ahead on the track. And this is the tree where this bird lives. And the bird flies in between this tree and the one next to it. And because I'm ignorant, I can't tell you what kind of bird that is. But I recognize its call. And it's always just there up on its own. Enjoying a bit of bird bants there. This is the kind of day that I will really miss when I'm dead. It's a cheery thought. I was listening to the radio the other day and the sports news came on and they were talking about this guy who's a rugby coach, I think. He's called Di Young. That is a good name. Well, I guess rugby's a dangerous game, isn't it? But you'd be better off fronting a punk band with that name. What he should do, of course, is find someone called Liv Long and marry her and then it'll balance out. Let me tell you about this week's podcast, number 43, which features a conversation recorded on my recent trip to Los Angeles with the American actor and comedian Nick Kroll. He invited me over to his house for a rambly chat. We talked about all the important stuff. Douches and what exactly defines a douche. As in the slang, not the actual sanitary product, I'm glad to say. We also ended up talking quite a lot about the actor James Franco. You know James Franco. Started out starring in Freaks and Geeks on US TV, Judd Apatow's TV show, and has gone on to appear in a variety of indie and mainstream movies over the years, including Danny Boyle's film, 127 Hours. I think he was nominated for an Oscar for his portrayal of a man who got his arm stuck in some rocks and decided to cut it off with a penknife. It's what I would do. The reason we were talking about James Franco was that Nick had just returned from the South by Southwest Music and Film Festival when I spoke to him, and he had seen James Franco's film, The Disaster Artist, which was a big hit, I believe, at the festival, and it chronicles the making of the 2003 cult film The Room, directed by Tommy Wiseau. We talked a bit about that and about the film industry's treatment of failure in general. You know me, I like talking about failure. I think it's interesting. We also spoke about Nick's recent Broadway comedy show, Oh Hello, which he wrote and performed with his friend comedian John Mulaney, playing a couple of characters that started life on Nick's Comedy Central sketch series called Kroll Show. So Nick told me how he got to know John Mulaney and how their first Broadway show turned out. And he also explained a little bit more about the whole world of improv. So I'll stop crapping on. I might just lie down in the grass in this field, pluck myself a dandelion clock, and lick it like a lolly while I'm staring at the clouds. Here we go!
This would be great for my sound effects album.
Yeah. This is a tiny red pepper I'm eating. They've miniaturized peppers here in the United States.
That's a weird one. It almost looks like a large chili pepper.
It looks like one, but it has the bland consistency of a regular bell pepper.
You think that's bland? Try one from the UK.
Aren't you known for your agricultural output?
Well, in parts of the UK, you can get some delicious bits and pieces, but I'm talking about supermarket food. And your average supermarket carrot, pepper, whatever it happens to be, is a pretty tasteless proposition.
Yeah, I would picture being like, go and pick up a box of peppers, is what I picture an English mum telling herself.
How's your English accent?
Surprisingly bad.
Yeah. What do you do when you need to do a Brit? What's your go-to accent?
I mean, there's a Disney villain version of it that I'm, I think, most comfortable with.
Mm-hmm. A kind of mustachio.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes.
Yes, of course. Something like that is the most comfortable. Chris Guest in The Princess Bride, the six-fingered man.
Mm-hmm.
I'm gonna jump right into the credits. I'm going to start dropping some credits right now.
I love it.
I was in a film called Sausage Party.
Oh, I liked it very much. Yes, you were the douche.
I was the douche. But the original version of the douche, when I did the table read of that film, this is a major motion picture.
Highest grossing R-rated animated feature of all time.
I wrote that down and handed it to you to make sure that you would say that.
Did I read it properly? Mm-hmm.
You read it beautifully.
Thank you.
Beautifully. But it was originally, when I did the table read, I knew Seth a little bit and those guys, and they asked me to do it, and it was like, oh, they couldn't get Ian McKellen or Patrick Stewart for the read, because the original douche was like
a British douche.
Yes. How dare you? You know, like of that sort of elk.
Have you ever heard of Brian Blessed?
I know the name.
Brian Blessed.
He was the head of the Hawkmen in Flash Gordon.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
Gordon's alive.
He was that guy.
I love that quality voice is a lovely. It's only actors have that voice.
Yes,
yes,
yes. Of course we will.
And you know who I mean by Matt Berry?
Yeah, of course. Yes. Yeah.
So he minds that scene brilliantly.
Is that how he speaks in life?
A little bit, yeah, a little bit. It's a sort of slightly more cockneyfied version of those characters.
But the quality is...
He's got a very rich...
Oh, it's a luscious
a
voice.
A rich timbre.
Yeah, it's gorgeous. So when we did the first table read of it, they had me do it that way. Mm. And then they were like, oh, like maybe we don't have to fucking deal with Ian McKellen or Patrick Stewart. We'll just have Kroll do it. Because that's the order. You go... And this is going to hurt Sir Pat.
Sure.
But it goes Sir Ian, Sir Pat, Nick.
Sir Kroll.
Sir Kroll. I
Lord Kroll.
Knock on wood.
Yeah.
That I'm going to get that night shift soon. But
the night shift.
I'm still waiting. So I recorded the movie. I did a bunch of sessions over a number of years as the douche, as this sort of like English villain. And then what they realized was like what they were making was a Pixar movie, but their villain was like a Disney villain. You know, it was like more of, so on the last session, they rewrote my character as the douche, which was, you know, ostensibly Bobby Bottle Service, a character that I had done, and had rewritten it as a modern douche is.
Right.
Someone maybe who would vacation in Blackpool. Have I done that right? Have I succeeded? No, not quite.
I don't know. I mean, I'm still, in America, how would you define a douche in US terms? Apart from, obviously, a female sanitary product.
Yes. I mean, a douche is, there's so many examples.
Trashy
and but also, showy and, like, people who, like, unironically loved Entourage at the end.
That's very specific.
Yes. Oftentimes aspirational and showing their wealth or the appearance of wealth in any manner they can.
Okay, right. So sort of flash and...
A lot of flash. So there was a show in the U.S. called Jersey Shore. It was a reality show. And then they did a... I remember seeing the British version of it. It was like tanned and...
Yeah, Essex. The Only Way is Essex, probably.
Yes, something like that, yes.
Yeah. It's less of a class thing in the US, though, isn't it?
It is, like most things, it's less of a class thing, theoretically, and yet it is very much broken up into class at some point, but not in the same way that it seems to be in the UK.
Mm.
But, yeah.
The Entourage at the end. Yeah. I've just got to deal with that, first of all. What was the deal with Entourage at the end? Because it started off, it's one of those shows I feel as if I completely got the wrong end of the stick from the very beginning. Mm-hmm. Like, I thought that it was this brilliantly counterintuitive show that, you know, most programs, most films would talk about the bad side of fame and point out how meaningless and shallow the whole pursuit of fame is. Mm-hmm. Here was a show, though, that celebrated it unironically. Mm-hmm. And I thought that that was a sort of conscious, clever move on their part. And, it actually seemed like it had worked. It was an enjoyable show to watch. And you sort of vicariously enjoyed the good life
for sure
through these guys, and it seemed like whenever there should be a beat where one of them got addicted to something or things went wrong, it didn't happen. Things just went well.
Yeah, it was a wonderful, and that's how I remember, you know, it was like that HBO Sunday night block where you had The Sopranos, Sex and the City, Curb Your Enthusiasm, and Entourage, and it was they were all very different and all very enjoyable for different ways. And I remember genuinely enjoying it. And then I remember poor Entourage. It was like the last season of 6 Feet Under. I don't know if you watched that one season. Just got so heavy, and then like, oh yeah, you know, like Entourage comes on, and you're like, oh boy, like you all of a sudden, and it was like season 6.
Yeah. Now you're just back from South by Southwest, aren't you?
I am.
How was that?
I love it.
What were you doing there?
What was I doing there? I was presenting the Texas Film Hall of Fame. No big deal. Mm. I was introducing my friend Sarah Green, who's a producer, who was getting inducted, as well as Jeff Nichols, who directed this movie, Loving, that I was in this past year. Second movie I've dropped of my career.
I didn't know you were in that.
I'm in that film.
I still haven't seen it. Want to see it. I'm a big fan of Jeff Nichols.
Oh, the best. I mean, I love the movie, but I love his films. And so Sarah is his producer, and so they were both being inducted in the... He lives in Austin, and she's spent many, many years there working with Jeff and Terrence Malick. And so I went down for that, and then got to just hang out and did a few shows, Comedy Bang Bang, and I did a conversation with Nick Offerman, two Nicks on stage, one a fuller beard than the other. He's got a great beard, and he's a real man, and he works with wood.
Harrison Ford / Jesus.
Yes. Yes, true, truthful. Smokes less weed than both of them.
Mm.
And I saw some movies. What did I see? Malick's movie, Song of Song.
Oh, that's... he even filmed some of that at South by Southwest,
didn't he? A ton of it is in, like, is in Austin is the focus of it, and a lot of it was filmed on stages at South by.
He started doing it about 500 years ago, didn't
yes.
he?
Yes, he did. And he...
So what sort of bands are in there? Hootie and the Blowfish. Doing there.
Yeah, it's Peter Frampton. no, but there is cool stuff. I mean, there are moments with Patti Smith and with Iggy Pop.
But I heard that no one actually plays anything. Or is it just the protagonists that don't play anything?
Yeah, they don't really. Gosling plays, you see him playing a bit and tinkering and writing and playing a bit. And Rooney Mara, you don't really see play very much.
Right, we should say for people who don't know what we're on about, this is a film, Terrence Malick film, that's about a relationship between these two musicians, right?
Yes, more or less. It's really, it's sort of Michael Fassbender and Ryan Gosling fighting over, directly or indirectly, over Rooney Mara. Yeah. And Fassbender is quite devilish, and Ryan Gosling's more of a, you know, charming romantic.
Yeah.
And it was cool to be in Austin to watch a movie about Austin.
Mm-hmm.
And then I saw The Disaster Artist, which is James Franco's new movie that Seth Rogen produced about the making of The Room, the Tommy Wiseau movie.
Right.
Have you seen it?
I've seen bits of it.
It's
never seen the whole thing. Should one see the
whole thing? One should see the whole thing.
Right, okay.
One should see The Room, because it is truly the best worst movie ever made as it is sold. I mean, it is, and I would assume your fans and people who are listening to this, my gut is would get quite a bit of joy out of it.
I would say most of the podcasts would be familiar
with
The Room. But if people aren't, where would they start with that?
Well, you can buy the DVD from Tommy Wiseau, yeah, who's the man behind it. And I believe the only place you can get it is not on Amazon. It's from like theroommovie.com or something like that.
When did he make it?
He made it in the early 2000s. But I remember just driving down in Los Angeles. You know, there are always like small billboards for movies that are getting no real distribution, but somebody's put up some money so that they can have a billboard. His was up for about 4 years. I mean, the picture of Tommy is one of the funniest images, even to the font. I mean, everything about it is wrong. He shot it on two cameras simultaneously. He shot it on film and on HD. And so most of the framing is off-center because he literally had cameras next to each other filming the same scene.
Right. What was the point of that?
He didn't know which one he wanted to eventually use.
Okay, keeping his options open. Exactly. Very, very wise.
So, obviously, this movie's truly wretched, but in it's beautiful and very pure.
Yeah.
And the guy Tommy made The Room with was this guy, Greg Sestero, and Greg eventually wrote a book. He's the best friend in the movie, and he's like the line producer and casting director. Greg wrote a book about his experience of making the movie. They then took that book and have adapted it into a film starring James Franco as Tommy Wiseau and his brother Dave as Greg, and the journey of them meeting and then making The Room. And I truly enjoyed it. I mean, Franco directed the movie as well, but he directed it as Tommy. He stayed in character the whole time.
Oh, my God.
Which, you know, is like, it's like taking Daniel Day-Lewis to the next level.
Yeah.
But everyone who worked on it, I think, had fun doing it. And I thought the final product was great. And I think Franco truly identifies with Wiseau as like someone who I think earnestly goes and takes chances and makes things and people make fun of him for it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think there's a real humanity in the final product. But it's also fucking hilarious. And if you know The Room, I mean, there's a ton of the movies in it and you see it.
The actual original bits, or do they recreate?
They recreate it. Right, end of the movie, you see some of the recreation side by side.
Oh, okay.
You know.
Did you see the Meryl Streep movie about the singer, what's her name?
Florence
Foster
no.
Jenkins.
Yes, I did not.
Yeah, worth seeing.
Yeah.
You got some similar themes there with an extremely talented performer, Meryl Streep, mm-hmm, playing this woman who was sort of deluded, quite rich and able to indulge this passion she had for music, despite the fact that she had no real talent for it.
Sure.
But because everyone around her was keen for her patronage financially,
they
encouraged her.
Yeah.
Until at a certain point, it was impossible for her to ignore that people were just laughing at her.
Yeah.
And there's a moment when Meryl Streep realizes this, that people have just been making fun of her, and actually this thing she loves doing, she has no real gift for. And it's heartbreaking, you know.
Yeah.
And it's sort of brilliant to see someone as talented as Meryl Streep playing this person who really doesn't have any talent.
Right.
But doing it in a way that is not at all sneery or mocking, you know.
Yeah, it's similarly, you watch that unfold in The Disaster Artist. And what was crazy is that The Room became a cult hit. He kept it in theaters and then people started going. And then it became like a Rocky Horror Picture Show where people would go and, you know, there were things that were happening in the movie that they then everyone would chant together, or people would, you know, have props and things like that. And Tommy would go to these screenings and speaks at the end. But he's now changed the narrative to saying he made a comedy.
Oh, right. Okay.
You know, so I think what was trippy was watching The Disaster Artist with him at the premiere. He had not seen this movie.
Uh-huh.
This was his first time seeing.
And presumably within the narrative of The Disaster Artist, it's not a comedy.
No. No, it is an earnestly made film.
Yeah. Was he happy with that? Or
well,
was he...
so we then, he was, it was it was unclear. They called everyone up on stage. He didn't speak afterwards, but we all ended up back at the hotel later that night, and Franco rolled up with Tommy and Greg. I was very stoned as well, and pretty drunk, But everyone sat down, and I found myself shaking uncontrollably. Like, the adrenaline or excitement of being in a room with two guys who had made a movie about two guys.
Mm.
And all of them there, and then Seth and James talking to Tommy and asking him what did he think of the movie, and Tommy being like, 99.9% I endorse this movie. It was just so surreal. It was felt so crazy and meta. And then it just was a joy. I literally found myself shaking. Like,
yeah.
Like I was you know when you were like a kid and you're about to make out with a girl for the first time and you're just...
I've read about it.
Yeah. I'm thinking like, when I say kid, I mean like, you know when you're like 21 and you're having your first kiss and you get like, all of a sudden you start to get shaky and you're like, I don't think this is horniness. I think this is just adrenaline and excitement and fear. And that's what it felt like sitting at this, just watching.
Mm.
Also, Tommy he has a line of men's underwear that he makes and jeans. So if you get into Tommy, go check out his underwear and jeans, his line. He's very interested in men's underwear.
Excellent.
Yeah.
And they are passionately made, but absolutely useless, presumably. They're very funny.
It turns out that they're a comedy. Yeah.
They were made seriously, but they're actually hilarious.
Yes, exactly.
James Franco, though, as you said, he's an interesting character because he treads that line between being sort of taking himself quite seriously and being able to laugh at himself.
Yes.
And I mean, I've never, not being an American and not being out here, I've never really been aware of him doing anything embarrassing. I think most of the stuff that would be considered embarrassing gets filtered out before it reaches us in the UK. So we only see the good stuff. I was aware of the fact that when he hosted the Oscars, that was supposedly embarrassing.
I think that was watch this. I was a part of the roast of James Franco on Comedy Central. So now we're getting into TV credits. I've moved over to some TV credits. And I did not know him before that, but I was asked to do it. And it was fun because it was the one way I would do a roast, I think, because it was like, we're not making fun of some albatross or some dinosaur of the business who is like clanging for one last, like, you know, wants to be back on TV or needs $1 million. It was like a relevant current person, which is like kind of what the roasts were back in the day when it was like Dean Martin and Sinatra and Don Rickles and all these guys who were still quite actively in their careers and doing stuff. So
yes, it's a peculiarly American tradition. I don't think we have anything like that.
No, the English just quietly roast each other constantly.
Yeah, we just internalize it and then bitch behind people's backs.
Yeah, or directly with sharp, very, just the thinnest blades that you can't even realize until later you realize you have a deep paper cut.
Yes,
of emotional brutality.
That's right. The withering of James Franco.
That's what it would be.
Yes.
But in researching him, you know, at the time it was at the height of him doing everything. I was just talking to him about being on Broadway,
mm-hmm.
which I'm going
to ask you about.
But yes. He had done Of Mice and Men, and so we were talking about what that schedule is like of doing a Broadway show, or as the West End
mm-hmm.
might be more analogous for you, so that you can understand what I'm talking
about. Thank you very much.
And he, you know, it's a pretty grueling schedule. It's 8 shows a week in 6 days.
Right. You do a matinee on Saturday.
We did a matinee Saturday, Sunday. Some people do a Wednesday, whatever it was.
Yeah.
He said he was flying back to LA to teach a class at UCLA or it might have been San Francisco. On his day off from Broadway, he was flying across the country to teach a class in screenwriting or filmmaking or something.
What a maniac. That's like a 7-hour flight.
Yeah. So that's the kind of, what was less embarrassing wasn't the work he was doing, it was the idea that he was going back to school, taking class, writing a poetry book, writing a play, making films with the classes that he was teaching. It was just he seemed to be making a ton of art and being experimental and taking chances. And so when, you know, it was the kind of thing where it was fun to make fun of, because it's like, haha, like how unironically you want to make art, you fucking piece of shit.
Yeah.
But as I was sort of, you know, trying to write jokes about it, my respect actually grew for him, which is like, oh, you unironically want to make art.
Yeah.
Or you're interested in something, you don't care whether people will say, like, what's he doing this, like, you know, experimental art? What's he doing making an art exhibit? You know, he's an actor or whatever it was. And so I think that's what he sort of got made fun of more than the actual physical work that he did.
Yes, yes.
You know?
I never saw him at the Oscars. What was the deal? He was
paired with Anne Hathaway to host the Oscars. And it was, I think, at a point when the Oscars was feeling particularly irrelevant. And so they thought they'd bring in two younger actors to come in and host it. So you had two hot young actors. And I think what it turned out to be, though, was it felt like you were watching the girl who was the president of the drama club being paired with the kid who was like smoking cigarettes out back, and the gay drama teacher was like, he should be in the play too. You know, and so you just had these two very different energies. And I think his misstep there, which I'm not one to judge or to publicly say something on a digital platform that can be pushed out into the world, into ears across the globe.
God forbid.
His one misstep from the rest of his career is that he felt a little too cool for school, and that when in reality he's not at all. I mean, he's a very genuine kind of performer, and it just felt like a moment where he was like, ooh, I've agreed to do this and now I'm retreating because I feel
right, you know. So he was all kind of a little bit slurry and like, I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. And that's not his actual vibe as an artist.
Okay. In this business, when your friends do something that doesn't work,
uh-huh,
how do you handle it? What's your personal policy on that whole thing? Huh. Is it to be always supportive by default with a friend, mm-hmm, and just say, yeah, it was fine. You know, you don't say too much about it to incriminate yourself, but yeah, you say, yeah, it was good. It was interesting. That bit really worked. That was fantastic. Or do you feel you owe it to them to be absolutely honest and say, you know what? I'm your friend and I think that you shouldn't have done that.
First off, if people ask you for notes or your real thoughts, that's one thing. I mean, I think what happens often is that people ignore the work when it's not good.
Mm-hmm.
Or they say, congrats, you've done it, or whatever it is. And I feel pretty capable on the receiving end of what the level of compliments. I feel like you can gauge a compliment.
Yeah.
Right? I specialize in my own version of self-hatred of gauging how genuine a compliment feels.
Yes.
I think oftentimes stuff goes unmentioned. You know what I mean? And the truth is there's so much stuff now that I just assume no one is watching or listening to my stuff, and that people expect this the same lack of
engagement
from me.
Yeah. No, people are busy. That's the thing, is you can't assume that everybody's seen everything.
But I, you know, when someone has a big public failure,
right,
if they're a friend, I try to be there for them and let them know that I think that they're funny and that I want to work, or whatever it is that they do, and that I want to work with them.
But you reserve the right to trash them on a podcast.
Of course.
Of course.
But I also think what I have learned is making anything is incredibly hard. Making a film, good or bad, and again, I think that's one of the great things about watching The Disaster Artist, is it makes you, it just makes you appreciate how fucking hard it is to make something. So even if I don't love a piece of art a friend makes, a show or a movie, a TV show or whatever, just the physical act of completing something like that or seeing what they were trying to do, I think there's always positive stuff to be found in that, because it's just incredibly hard.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's the thing, isn't it? It's difficult for people to understand that, I think, when they're just watching it, because you see the finished thing and it seems so obvious how you would fix it sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah, and I, you slowly are a part of things where you're like, wow, there's some of the most talented people I've ever met in the room working on this over time, and they did not figure it out.
Yeah.
Right, let's go again.
What don't you fucking understand?
Kick your fucking ass!
Let's go again!
What the fuck is it with you?
I want you off the fucking set, you prick!
No!
You're a nice guy!
The fuck are you doing?
No!
Don't shut me up!
No!
No!
Da-da-da-da like this!
No!
No!
Don't shut me up!
Da-da-da-da like this!
Fuck's sake, man, you're amateur!
Seriously, man, you and me, we're fucking done professionally.
You mentioned Broadway there.
Oh, I did. Did I?
Yeah, you slipped that in.
Oh, look at me.
You've been on Broadway for the last few months. Well, back in January, you finished your run.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes.
Is that your first time doing a show on Broadway?
Yes.
And that was Oh Hello.
That was Oh Hello with
John Mulaney.
With my friend John Mulaney, the deeply unfunny John Mulaney.
Wow, it's nice of you to take him along, give him a break.
Yeah.
How did your relationship with him start, and where did those characters start?
He and I met in college, university, and
where was that?
Georgetown University in Washington D.C. And we met when I was a freshman. I did this thing called the Funniest Act on Campus. It was a competition of stand up. I'd never done stand up before, and the whole bit I was going to do was pee my pants on stage. And say, I thought I was going to be so nervous, but I'm so relaxed, and then pee my pants. It did not work. I was going to bring a water balloon, and then I forgot the water balloon, and I bombed. In the same competition, the guy who won that competition was Mike Birbiglia.
Oh, yeah.
Who's a quite well-established stand-up and storyteller and filmmaker now. And he then cast me in a sketch show at the end of my freshman year.
He did piss his pants.
He did piss his pants.
He did it for real, though.
For real. Constantly over a number of years, and I want your listeners to know that podcasts that Mike Birbiglia is a pee-pee pants boy, and that shouldn't be forgotten.
He's a wee wee man.
He's a little wee wee man, and he's a pee-pee boy.
This is not true, by the way. This is an ironical riff.
This is one of these classic riffs where I trash my friend. But Mike cast me in this improv group, sketch group, and then when I was a senior. I cast John Mulaney as a wee freshman, and we just hit it off immediately, became very close friends. And when I graduated, I moved to New York, and he would come to New York, and he lived on my couch one summer, and we would do, open mics, and we started writing little pieces together. And then we started doing these characters. I would host a show in the East Village. I was hosting with my friend Jesse Klein, another very talented comedian and writer. And then she moved to LA, and I asked John if he wanted to host the show with me. And we started hosting as these characters who were two Upper West Side men, turtleneck blazer, NPR listening, I guess, coffee breath, tote bags, Woody Allen, Alan Alda obsessed.
Right, okay, because John sounds a little bit like Alan Alda.
Yes.
Yeah.
So that was always our way in, was it's like two divorcees from the Upper West Side were obsessed with Alan Alda. And the English, knowing a Woody Allen film, that kind of guy where we were obsessed with the idea that an architect in his late 40s in corduroys with balding, women could be he's irresistible.
Yes.
You know what I mean? It's that
going out with a much younger, much more attractive woman.
Yeah. Like that we would, go to a dinner party with our friends and a 14-year-old girl and nobody would blink an eye.
Yeah.
We became very obsessed with that kind of man. And so we started hosting a show as them, this stand-up show, and our friends would do a set, and then we would interview them and just fuck with them, And it was Jiminy Glick had come out and...
Martin Short's character.
Yes.
Yeah, who's brilliant. He's not that well-known in the UK, that character, but it's so great.
It's so deeply fun. And I think the UK has a stronger tradition of it with, Alan Partridge and Sasha with
Ali G
and all those characters where the interviewee becomes the straight man to the character doing the interview.
Yeah.
Where you're punching down.
Yeah.
But it's the most fun. And so we had, you know, we basically did our version of that. And we would interview our friends, our stand-ups, and they would have to deal with it. Anyway, then we stopped doing the show. I moved to L.A. John became a writer on SNL. And then I got a sketch show, and we started doing those characters on my sketch show, on Kroll Show. And they developed a thing called a prank show called Too Much Tuna, where we would prank unsuspecting guests at lunch with too much tuna fish. Also pointless. I still am not exactly clear what is funny about
it. Where did that come from?
Well, we had...
You're just trying to think of the lamest prank.
No, it came originally where actually John and Jesse, my friend who I'd mentioned, we were all at lunch one day and she got like a salade niçoise and it came and there was just a ton of tuna on it. And she was like, this is too much tuna. And we were like, that's a funny talk show where it's like, welcome to Too Much Tuna. I guess today is Adam. And then the plates get served and go, this is too much tuna, you know? And so it started there. And then I told that to my writer's room and the writers were like, oh, that's funny. It was one of those things where, you know, you have a bit with your friend and you're like, all I do is think of bits to produce. And that one was just like, well, that's just for us. And then everyone was like, oh, that's funny. Then we turned that into a prank show where they prank people with too much tuna fish, a big mountain of tuna.
Yeah.
And we did it on Kroll Show as a kind of a recurring sketch. And we, you didn't ask for the history of this, but I thought...
No, I did, actually. Okay, I specifically asked for the history.
Okay, great. So then we were promoting season 3 of Kroll Show, and we did a In Conversation With at the 92nd Street Y in New York. You have YMCAs, but the Y is a real mecca for these kinds of guys. You know what I mean? Who would use the pool and play racquetball and go to, like, lectures. You know, they could make... our characters could make a whole weekend at the Y.
I don't know if we have an equivalent in the UK, really. I mean, there must be, but it's...
It's sort of a public-private... You know, it's
like a club,
it's almost a club, but it's a theoretically largely public in its own capacity.
Yeah.
And it's a very New York thing of the past, really, more than anything. So we appeared live as those characters and got interviewed by Willie Geist, who's one of the co-hosts of the Today Show. And we just largely improvised for an hour and a half. We gave him some questions and he had questions and we just fucked around. And it was it was like 900 people. We hadn't performed the characters live in 7-8 years. And it was deeply fun. And then everyone was like, what's next? And we both immediately said, Oh Hello on Broadway. And it was a joke. And then we sort of took a beat and we were like, this is not a joke.
Because Oh Hello was the name of the sketch and the character.
It was called, Oh Hello. You know, and that was the name of the sketch for whatever reason. That's how, you know.
Yeah.
And so we said Oh Hello on Broadway. And it was a joke, but then it got very quickly very serious because what we had been bandying about for a long time and what our influence on those guys more than anything was sort of Carl Reiner and Mel Brooks, The 2000-Year-Old Man, and Nichols and May.
Yes.
Except we have no straight man between us. But it was sort of that something about the banter of those two guys on stage live enjoying each other and that sort of patter, that more classic kind of patter. So we then were like, well, let's go to Broadway. And everyone in our life who on the work side was like, you don't have a fucking script. And we're like, oh, okay. So then we booked an off-Broadway theater, the Cherry Lane Theater in the West Village, and which is an amazing, beautiful, storied old theater. We booked it for a month, 3 months out, and we were like, all right, we got 3 months to write a play, which we wrote in L.A. and then brought to New York and teched it for 2 days with our director who had not seen it basically until we got to New York. This guy, Alex Timbers, who's a truly amazing director. He's directed David Byrne's 2 musicals in New York,
really?
Here Lies Love and Joan of Arc, and did Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson, and has done just a bunch of theater, classic theater, but is a really sharp sort of subversive mind. And as I talk about all this process, it's, I think, actually more similar to the process of going to Edinburgh or putting a show together.
Right, okay, yeah.
But it's not as common here.
Yes, in America, comedians generally do specials, which will just be like jokes.
Yes, and they get a sketch show,
right?
And we used to, I think, do more like our live sketch show that hopefully will get us a deal to develop to do something. But now, you just don't need it as much.
Yeah, and the template in the UK is much more, you do a show about something, and it's an hour long,
And you do a new one every year, which seems like a nightmare.
I did it once, and I just thought, nah, that's enough for me.
Well, but also your stuff is quite, it's labor intensive too. I feel like having watched you perform, it's quite labor intensive.
Yeah, although the thing I did first in Edinburgh in 2005 was a character.
Uh-huh.
And I crowbarred in some of my videos and bits and pieces into this character who was, he's kind of a East European animator. It was quite pretentious and, wrote a lot of poems and got quite angry sometimes. And then, would show you this thing that he had made.
You weirdly look like you could be a Eastern European.
Yeah, well, I grew a big... That's when I first grew a beard, was for this thing, to age myself up a little bit. And then after that, when I got back from Edinburgh and I shaved it off, it was so alarming. I'd got used to it for a whole year, And it was a big old fucking...
Did you like it?
Pirate beard. I quite liked it. I mean, it was a bit out of control. It was a bit mad looking. There's an actor called James Nesbitt in the UK. Mm-hmm. And I found myself next to him in a urinal one time. And he looked over and went, Jesus fucking Christ, that's grotesque. That's a bad James Nesbitt impression. But it was just total contempt. I think he knew who I was, and he was shocked by how I looked with this giant beard. But anyway,
you said urinal. We would call it a urinal.
A urinal. Yeah.
Urinal sounds like you're buying a record.
Well, yes, you put the stress on the first syllable, don't you, for urine, and I suppose we do as well. No, I don't know.
You don't say urine?
I don't say, we don't say urine, and we say...
I want you to... Urinate in my mouth.
You do that thing with the characters for the Oh Hello characters of doing contractions.
Yes, Bridway.
Yeah, so instead cocaine. Of saying cocaine, so instead of saying Ted Cruz and James Brown, it's...
James Brown, you want to do a little cocaine with Ted Cruz? Would be the... Yeah, it was a very... Mulaney said early on, said cocaine... And it just like, it literally, this was when we were sort of, formulating these guys. And he said cocaine, and it just like, every synapse in me exploded, being like, that's the funniest fucking word I've ever heard.
Yeah.
And it became a major, and then we just built it out kind of from there. And it's a show about two men who are being kicked out of their rent-controlled apartment. And it's by Gil and George, and they're playing two characters named Gil and George. And then the play breaks down. But we set up the play as like all the things that we quote-unquote love about plays, like one-sided phone calls where the one character says all the information out loud so that the other person knows, or the dim lines, the last line you say just as, and then the lights dim, and you're sitting in your seat and you're like, is that the fucking end of the play? And then in the play, we end up, using a bunch of those tropes.
Yes. Did you go to the theater a lot before you did that? I mean, would you see plays?
I sort of do. I mean, it's like a weird thing of like, we love plays and I have a ton of contempt for plays. I find plays embarrassing. Just how I found sketch shows embarrassing at some point, where it's like, we're all going to pretend we're not in the same room right now. Like, oh, they're in a Chinese restaurant. Okay. Or like, oh, they're in a Victorian home? Okay. It's like, no, some guy just farted in the crowd. Like, we're all here in the room. We heard that guy fart. We're not going to talk about that. But again, once we were in New York and we eventually went back and got on Broadway, and you all of a sudden can appreciate how hard it is to make a play or go to see musicals, which aren't inherently my favorite. But then you see a musical and you're like, holy shit, I can't believe how hard this is to pull off.
Yes, and there are moments because of that thing that you just mentioned, the ludicrousness of everybody sat there in the same room. But when it works, it is sort of magnificent that human beings are able to do this for each other.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
I saw A Curious Incident of the Dog.
In the Night.
Yes. Like, you see a show like that, and I was blown away by the entirety of the production, of the performances, the set, the music. I mean, I just was in awe of it. And so there were things like that were inspiring. Or I saw a play downtown by this woman, Annie Baker, and it was a 3-hour play, and there was 3 characters and 1 set, and you're just like, oh my God, I can't believe I'm walking into a 3-hour play. But it was...
I wouldn't have done.
But it was... And the play is in real time.
Yes.
So scenes take a long time to play out. Like you're watching people clean a movie theater, and it's 3 people who work in a movie theater that, and you watch scenes in real time. But for whatever reason, it is so beautiful. It was so beautifully written and directed and acted that it was riveting to watch. But while that's happening, a woman in the crowd opened a plastic container of blueberries and started eating them.
Was this a real woman or?
This is a real woman. So I'm watching the play, but then I start watching this woman eat blueberries.
So she's not a plant.
No, she is not a plant. Yeah. She's just there. And then I watch an older man, like our Oh Hello age guy, watching the woman eat the blueberries and getting so furious with this woman who's crinkling her plastic as she eats her blueberries and, you know, nudging his wife who's now being drawn into this. And so much of what the show is about is really also the experience of just going to the theater.
So much of your show.
Yes.
Yes, yes.
So there's like, you know, the experience of what it's like to go to a theater and bring your little plastic candies and what it's like to sit and listen to people, you know, so.
People taking phone calls.
And... Yeah, exactly. Which we encourage people to do.
Did you really?
Take calls, text people.
Get selfies.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, it was... We did it off Broadway, and then we toured it around the country, and then brought it back to Broadway, and we did like 138 shows, 140 shows.
God, that's a lot.
It was the most fun.
And how big was the theater that you were doing it in the end, then?
It was 900, 950, whoa, something like that.
That's a load.
We had to sell a lot of tickets.
Yeah, shows in the West End and on Broadway. Mm-hmm. Often close after only a few weeks because it's so difficult to fill those theaters.
Yeah, we got very lucky. The confluence of various things that led us to it, just the timing of it, it was the fall. We also interviewed someone live in the middle of the show. We would quote-unquote prank someone with too much tuna in the middle of our show, which was a great way to get friends and crazy special guests and heroes to come do the show.
What kind of people did you manage to get in there?
Oh, man. I mean, friends like, you know, someone like a guy who I... Jason Mantzoukas, a good friend who I've worked with for a long time. Or Paul Rudd or Schumer, Amy Schumer, or Chris Pratt. Then to, like, heroes like Seinfeld, Colbert, David Letterman did our final show, Steve Martin, Michael J. Fox.
Oh my God.
And everyone at Yitzhak Perlman, like the, you know, like we had every kind of person. Barney Frank, who's the first openly gay congressman. Alana Glazer from Broad City. So, and both contemporaries, heroes, everyone.
How extraordinary. And what would you say to them? I mean, how would it work for them? Would they have to do any prep?
No, it was, they would come backstage before the show. We'd chat with them for 5-10 minutes and we'd basically say, thanks for coming. So basically, almost everybody came out of the crowd. They would watch the show, and there was something, I think, joyful for the crowd to be like, oh, wow, this person's been sitting here watching the show with us, and then now they're on stage. And we would call them from the crowd halfway through the show, and we would sit and interview them. And we would say, like, well, we'll just chat for 10, 15 minutes, and then a tuna sandwich will appear. And it would be dropped from the rafters, and we would say, what is just descended from this prop that we stole from an old Chihuahua production of Angels in America? And then it would be a huge mountain of tuna with a piece of bread teetering on top, and we would talk about the tuna sandwich. And then the only thing they had to do was say, that's too much tuna. Uh-huh. And when they'd say that, we would... Calypso music would come on and we would celebrate. And then we would send them off the stage. And so it was very loose and silly, and people played it differently. Some people were angry. I mean, faux angry and wouldn't take shit from us. And others laughed. And, you know, it's an interesting thing when, again, you go back to that, when the interviewee is the straight man of sorts, well, how far will, you know, do they try to be funny or not? For the most part, people would sort of allow us to sort of run wild, but sometimes they would equally run wild with us, and it was like everything everything I'd ever wanted show business to be. It was live every night. We got to change jokes that weren't working and polish things, and then you'd have interesting people coming to see the show or being a part of the show, and then you'd go and have a drink. I drank like 1,000 martinis.
Yeah, it must be hard to sort of keep yourself relatively together when you've got that sort of routine and the excitement and the pressure of doing the show, mm-hmm. then coming off stage, you need to sort of unwind a little bit, don't you?
And yeah. I mean, that's why I would smoke heroin. I was never shooting it because I just needed to unwind.
Absolutely.
But I wasn't an addict. I'm not an addict.
You should rub it into your gums.
Oh, I do every day.
Or into your rectum.
Yeah, I put it straight up into my rectum. Yeah, if you spray it.
Oh.
Into your rectum.
A mist.
Yeah, a mist. It'll get right into the bloodstream.
Nice heroin mist.
Yeah, and my butt is not as motivated as it used to be, but it's...
Hey, whose is?
That's right.
You wait. You're a young man.
But yeah, it was true joy to do.
So you destroyed Broadway.
We destroyed it. It was the most fun thing I've ever done, and I'm willing to say possibly the most fun, joyful, gratifying thing I will ever do professionally.
Does that make you keen to develop another project for the theater?
I think John and I would like to maybe work on another one, or we're going to continue to work with these guys. Our goal is to do these guys until we are the age of that they are.
Yes, you could be like Steve Coogan. I mean, Steve Coogan is now approaching, I think he's sort of more or less in the zone for optimum Alan Partridge.
Right, just with minimal...
Minimal makeup. Yeah. Although he's pretty fit and he's sort of fitter and better looking than Partridge would be, I suppose.
Yes.
I talked to Steve for this podcast and he was saying that he doesn't feel pressure to churn out new stuff.
Yeah.
They only do things when... When they sure. feel like
well,
there's
when
something funny.
When you become iconic, that takes a little of the pressure.
Yeah, I suppose. Yeah, yeah.
But also, there are so many different... And I don't know if it's the case in the UK, but because of like streaming services, there's become more models for through which to make content when you want.
Yes, that's right.
You don't have to make like a show. You're like, I'm inspired to make this special for this year or something like that. And I think that is inspiring.
Yeah, and people, you know, your fans will find it.
Yeah. And not daunting, you know? So, like, I just watched The Lonely Island and Comedy Bang Bang, you know, the Michael Bolton Valentine's Day special on Netflix. So, you should watch. It's very funny, and it's got a bunch of great cameos, and they just decided to make a bizarre piece of content. It's an hour, and it's a really joyful thing to watch.
Did you do the whole improv thing when you were younger?
I did, I studied in college. We had an improv group and we studied with the Upright Citizens Brigade in New York. And then when I came to New York, I studied there and started working. And if you look for sure on the comedy landscape right now on television and film, you could point to, I would say, if, you know, half to three quarters of the people on those shows or movies have some history at UCB.
That seems to be the way for a lot of comedians to go, as you've just said. Mm-hmm. In the States, it's beginning to come through a little bit in the UK, the whole improv thing, but it's not nearly so common. What's the average, like, what kind of things do you do in the classes then?
You know, there's exercises that are probably not different from what you do in a class, you know, any sort of
acting class
right. and improvisation, but what happens is, I mean, there's a couple of things. One, there's the basic premise of like what they would say is teaching the game of the scene. You're like, what is the funny thing about this scene? And you get trained to then figure out how to write three more versions of it, heightening just like any joke we would do. You'd try to heighten the joke and find different ways of playing that joke. So there are skills like that. But more than anything, it's like community. I mean, they taught incredibly useful pieces of how to improvise and then how to write sketch and things like that, but also you're just going to be able to go to a place and meet other funny people who are weird and interesting like you or interested like you, and it just, the difference between your classic improviser, sketch comedian, and a stand-up is that just the concept of collaboration, people who are seeking other people to collaborate with versus being an island. But what's been interesting, I think, as stuff like podcasts and all that, we've seen a meshing of those worlds where quote-unquote improvisers are writing because everyone eventually has to write, and classic stand-ups or individual acts are realizing they can collaborate and do different things with different people. So I think those lines have blurred a lot more than they have in the past.
Can I go to an improv class now that I'm nearly 50?
Of course.
Does it happen, though?
Oh, yeah.
Do you get oldies turning up?
Well, yeah, I think you, I mean, you're not an oldie.
Thanks.
You're a goodie. No, I mean, that's kind of the beauty. I mean, what was fascinating about taking the classes is, and I don't know what it's like now. I mean, I took classes now almost probably about 15 years ago when I graduated college. And, you know, you'd have like crazy people. You'd have performance artists who were just there and like weird New York freaks. You had medium funny people. And then you have the people who have become the biggest comedy acts in the country, all in the same room doing the same show. And you sort of realize you find the people who you're like, oh. But I think the beauty of it and those classes too is that you have people of all ages. And I mean, there are movie stars taking UCB classes.
Uh-huh.
Now.
Right, who have become stars and then gone and started doing the classes.
Yeah, they're like, I want to learn how to improvise. Like, How does that guy do that thing?
Yeah, yeah.
And they've then been like, you know, if they've done a movie with someone who's improvised, and then they're like, I want to learn that. And all of a sudden you show up in your class and it's like, oh, there's a movie star in my class.
Yeah.
Who wants to understand the act of it. And yeah. It's muscle. It's a muscle like everything else, you know?
Mm.
It's like, because I was an improviser and then did stand-up and character work and then was drawn more to that side of it. I was performing at UCB, but I wasn't on an improv team. I was just doing characters and stand-up and all that stuff. And we do bits on people's shows. But it took me a while to get back to actually doing improv. And that muscle needs to be exercised. Just
like masturbation.
Yeah. And that's what I combined the two on stage. I would improvise masturbation scenarios.
Quite right. There's not too much of that sort of stuff around these days, is there? Like extremely gross acts as part of an art performance.
There was that puppetry of the penis.
Yeah, but they weren't like, that wasn't a sexy thing, really,
no,
was it? Did you ever see puppetry of the penis?
I did not. Did you?
I did a TV show with a guy who was in it for a while.
Uh-huh.
And he showed us some of his moves in between takes.
Mm-hmm.
And it was pretty impressive.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was really stretching
the boundaries of how was his hog?
It was very unthreatening.
Uh-huh.
That was one of the nice things about it.
Sure.
It didn't look remarkable.
That's what most people have said about me.
Yeah. But, and I wonder if they've said this about you, mm-hmm. Incredibly pliable.
Well, I remember early, I was saying in New York early on, you know, there was a mix of you do open mics and there was a real crossover between experimental performance art and stand-ups. Everybody just looking for a stage to perform on. So there early on, I definitely remember doing shows where there was guys doing stuff with their penis. It wasn't puppetry of the penis. It was just playing with their dicks on stage. Or, you know, a guy, I remember the guy who hosted this show was not a comedian exactly. And he would do contests throughout the show and give out what he said was, quote, disturbingly jackable porn.
Uh-huh.
And then I was coming up and doing just classic stand-up. And we were all in the same room together.
Yes.
And it was fun.
Yes. I mean, you know, it's always good for a little frisson of shock, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, there was Gigi Allen. Do you remember Gigi Allen?
Of course.
Flinging his feces into the audience. Yes. I mean, he was a punk rocker.
Yeah, but it was...
I've never been up for that personally. If I hear that someone's going to be lobbing their turds... I generally stay away.
No, yeah, I watched a video of him, but I did not get to see him live.
No.
No, I have a limited tolerance for performers who have deep contempt for the crowd. The first lesson I learned, it took me a while to learn it, and the only piece of advice I give to people who want to do comedy or whatever, is just get on stage and make the audience feel like you're in charge. And sometimes that means having a contempt for them. But sometimes it just means like everything's going to be fine. I find sometimes when some people have a seemingly contempt for the audience and lash out, the audience is like, what?
Yeah. I don't like it when comedians in a confident way put the audience down for not laughing enough.
Yes.
Because actually it's doing the opposite of what they want. It's revealing to the audience that they're insecure about the amount of laughs they're getting.
Correct.
Now, one of the things, Nick, I met you first a couple of years ago in Dublin.
Yes.
At the Comedy Festival. It was a great pleasure. And I got to take a selfie and text it to our mutual friend, Garth Jennings.
Yes.
And because you were in Sing.
Yes.
You were Gunther.
I was Gunther, the dancing Gunther. European pig.
Euro techno pig.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Garth brought me in. I had done a European character on my show, and I think he responded to that version, and then we changed it quite, because the European character on my show turned out to be a cannibal, a murderous cannibal.
What was the name of that character?
Euro guy. He never got he was just a European was his name. And he was sort of like, you know, who I, let's for breakfast would do like 2 or 3 cigarette and then a bowl of heavy cream. And then for lunch, it's 2 or 3 bottle red wine and then 2-pack Marlboro cigarette. And and then for dinner, we'll do something healthy, like 4 or 5 sausages. So what became Gunther was quite different. But on the show, I was quite inspired by, I can't remember his name, the German guy who got online and to become a cannibal.
That's right.
Ermin Muse. Slaughter and consume you. He got online and said, is there anybody interested in being slaughtered and consumed?
And someone got in touch.
Someone got in touch and he did it.
Yeah.
Gunther, however, the dancing pig in the children's film I played for Garth. Is not that. But it was very fun.
It seemed to be that the Gunther poster was the most ubiquitous around the world.
It was very weird.
I went skiing and there was a giant Gunther staring down at me at the ski lift.
Yeah, it was very, very bizarre. Because the movie is like Matthew McConaughey and Scarlett Johansson and Reese Witherspoon.
Yeah.
And big, huge movie stars. And there were Gunther posters. Less a testament to me and more to, I think, just a positive dancing pig.
Yeah, people like pigs.
People love pigs. I love to eat them.
Yeah.
Wait. This is an advert for Squarespace.
Hey guys, it's Broshak with me, Paul Broshak. We got Mike here. We're going to talk about his new MMA comedy special. We're going to talk about his view counts, and we're going to talk about conspiracy theories. What's up, Mike?
Hello, Paul.
Hey, brother.
I'm fine, thank you. I don't want to talk about any of those things anymore.
You don't?
No. I want to talk about... I built a website, Paul.
All right, stream some fights, settle some beefs, stick it to the elites, that kind of thing.
No, it's mainly dog pictures, Paul. And I did it on Squarespace. Have you heard of Squarespace? I went to squarespace.com/Buxton and I did a free trial. And I tried some of the beautiful templates, Paul, and I typed things in. I dragged in pictures of the dogs. And before I knew it, I had a website, Paul. So I bought it and I've made some very sweet dog t-shirts and I sell those on the shop on the website.
Uh-huh. But do you still fight and stuff?
A little bit, but not really. Oh, and Paul, I wanted to tell you that when it comes time to buy your website or domain on Squarespace, if you use the offer code Buxton, you save 10%. Paul.
Thanks, Mike. Where'd you do that free trial?
Squarespace.com/Buxton.
And how sweet were the dogs?
Very.
Continue.
Good panting there, Rosie. It's a lovely day, isn't it? Are you feeling hot? Because you've got your coat on.
I got my coat on. I got my black woolly coat on.
Can you not take it off?
No. It's on there all the time. Permanent fashion item, isn't it?
Fair enough.
Nick Kroll there. Thank you so much to him for giving up his time. Very much enjoyed meeting Nick. And before I say goodbye today, a couple of bits of business. Due to popular demand, we have released a second unsigned edition of the Ramble Chat posters that I told you about a couple of weeks back and which sold out very fast. It's a 4-color screen print. I believe it's around A3 size or something like that. You'll be able to see on my blog if you go to adam-buxton.co.uk and click on the merch button. You'll find a few bits and pieces, including some more of these posters, which were created by artist Luke Drozd. And as I said, they sold out very fast when they were first available. Secondly, I've got a few shows coming up, the Bug Bowie specials. So that's a celebration of Bowie's music videos and other assorted visual odds and sods.
along with commentary from the YouTube community on a couple of occasions, and bits of animation that I've had created. And, you know, there's serious bits and stupid bits. You don't have to be a hardcore Bowie fan to enjoy it, I don't think. I'm doing it at the Brighton Festival at the Brighton Dome on Tuesday, the 23rd of May, but I think that's sold out. I'm doing it in Oxford, though, on Wednesday, the 24th, and in Birmingham on Thursday, the 25th. And I believe there are still tickets left for those shows as I speak. I'll put details once again on my blog, adam-buxton.co.uk, in the badly maintained events section. So maybe I'll see you at one of those shows. Hope so. Hey, Rosie. You want to come and lie down with me?
What are you doing? Why are you lying down? It's the middle of a day. It's a work day.
I know, but it's... We're lucky. We can do this. We should take advantage of this good weather while we can.
It's weird. You're weird. You should go home. Send some emails. Do some important grown-up things.
I will in a bit. All right, listeners, take care. I'm not going to yell because it'll spoil the moment. Rosie will run off. I love you. Bye. Oh, not. I do love you, Rosie, but don't kiss me. All right. See ya.
Bums up. Nice like a pat when my bums up.